Yes, please. Hi, everyone. My name's Lily. I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor or privilege to serve an Alcoholics Anonymous in any capacity, but I have to tell you that no one is more astounded than I am that I'm a speaker at any AA function. I don't know how you fall off in a bar in Windham, Maine and end up, in Columbus, Georgia to speak at a convention. But I'm here. I'd like to thank the committee, and I'd like to thank Jody and Edie. I'd like to thank Jody in particular for all her assistance in my getting here. She was a big help to me, and I really appreciate that. And thank you for the basket that you presented me to me. I enjoy it, and it's just hard to get those baskets on a plane back home, you know what I mean? But I've eaten everything that was in it, so good. So I'd like to start out by telling you that this afternoon, you know how you get on your cell phones and they have these things, you know, like, you know, what's your real name or, you know, who are you in 2025? Well, today there was a test on there and it wanted, what is your real Celtic name? Well, I decided I must know what that is before this function. And I want you to know that my real Celtic name is Kalian, the scoundrel from the pub. Not about hard work, but about having fun. I would have spent the majority of my time in bars and pubs, drinking with the boys, and flirting with fellow Celts. That's it. I can sit down now. I did not come from a dysfunctional family. I know that a lot of you did, but that's not my story. You know, I had a loving home, and I had a mom that stayed home and took care of the kids. Both of my grandmothers lived with me. I have three brothers and then adopted my cousin that my mother adopted. So mom stayed home every day. She did the things that stay-at-home moms do. You know, she cooked and cleaned. She had us ready for school. We had three square meals a day. She made homemade dessert every night. My dad came home at 4 o'clock every single afternoon. You could set your watch by that. You know, he would walk in the house. Mama would be standing at the sink doing the pre-supper dishes, and he would say to her, "Hi, honey, how was your day? Where are the kids?" I don't know. I don't believe that they ever had a problem with alcohol. The only time, my dad used to come home in the summertime once in a blue moon, and he'd have 2 quarts of beer, and he would split that with all the adults in the house. Yeah, I never understood that. You know, I never understood it. I don't understand it now. If somebody said to me during my drinking career, if somebody said to me, "Would you like to go out and have a drink?" No. But if they said, "We're going to have a couple of drinks," those are the folks that I went with, because they were starting with a couple, you know. But it wasn't always that way. You know, I was brought up, I was raised as an Irish Catholic. I don't have issues with that. I'm still a member in good standing of the Catholic Church. I actually had my first drink of alcohol at the age of 19. But I want to tell you a little story before I had my first drink of alcohol. When I graduated from high school, if your date wasn't from the graduating class, they could not go to the banquet. So therefore, I'm not going to go to the banquet because my date is not going to be able to go. And his parents were well-to-do, and they invited us to go to this restaurant called the Portlander. And my mom and dad saved up their money, and they got me a beautiful dress, and it had a big hoop skirt. Now, I know that you Southern girls know about those hoop skirts, but this northern girl didn't know anything about a hoop skirt or what to do with it. I also had what was popular at the time were these white spike high heels. So we go to the Portlander, and I'm all dressed up in this gown, and his parents got all dressed up, and he was all dressed up. And we went into this restaurant. It was really a fancy place. Now, I'd never been to a restaurant like that with my family. I mean, we would go to a hamburger joint, but my father couldn't afford to take us to this fancy restaurant. They came with these menus, and they were like this big, and they had tassels hanging off of them. And I was like, ooh. You know, and his dad said to me, "You can have anything you want." And I opened the menu, and I didn't know what I wanted, so I ordered the fillet mignon. And The waitress wanted to know how I wanted it, and I said, cooked. I knew nothing about any of that, you know, but they brought this beautiful meal. They put it down in front of me, and I went to cut the steak, and when I did, it slid off my plate. And I didn't want them to think I was, you know, like ignorant, so I kicked it under the table. And then I sat there all pretty in my skirt with a hoop that, by the way, the first time I sat on it went whoosh like that. And his dad looked over at me and I said, man, I was really hungry, you know. And we finished the meal, and as we get up to leave, I realized I had skewered that steak with the heel of my shoe. And I sort of walked out of the restaurant like Groucho Marx, you know. And 6 months later, I added alcohol. The occasion was my wedding reception, and I didn't know anything about drinking. What I knew about drinking was what I'd seen on TV. And Lucy and Desi were going to cocktail parties. And we walked in, and my dad said, what are you going to have, honey? And I was like, I don't know, Daddy, what are you having? And he said, I think I'll have a whiskey and ginger. Well, this was at the VFW. So if you've ever drank in a service club, you know what that's like. You know, you ask for a whiskey and ginger, and you get a lot of whiskey and a little bit of ginger. And he said, here's to you, kid. What I knew about drinking was watching TV, and when they said, here's to you, you downed the drink. So I downed the drink, and the next thing I remember, I was taking the wedding gown off on the front lawn. And that's the way my drinking career was going to be. I don't know what it is about alcoholic women, but we get to a certain point where we feel it's necessary for you to see our boobs. I don't know what causes that, but, you know, it's happened to me a lot. I used to lose my clothes. I wouldn't know where they were. I mean, I didn't know where I was, so how was I supposed to know where my clothes were? And it's not what I aspired to be. You know, the man that I married was alcoholic, and I didn't even know that. How I knew he was an alcoholic is I had told him that when we got married, I said, you'll be just like my dad. You come home every single day at 4 o'clock. And he was like, okay. And he did. He came home every day at 4 o'clock, and he liked to sit on the floor in front of the chair and lean up against the chair. And this is how I knew that he had a drinking problem. He got up one time to go to the bathroom, and there was an outline of his body in beer cans on the floor. And I thought, you know, he might have a problem. You know, and then I would hear him talking to his friend, and they would talk about going out and doing some serious drinking. And I wanted to be a serious drinker. I realized right away that I was a lightweight, one drink, and I'd be drunk. I'd be in a barroom fight. Why? I don't know. Or I'd be losing my clothes. So I decided that I wanted to be a serious drinker. I needed to learn how to do this. I called his friend. I said, Pete, how, you know, you talk about being a serious drinker. How do you get to be a serious drinker? And he said, well, Lily, you really are a lightweight. And so somebody like you, you probably ought to coat your stomach. And I was like, well, what do you coat it with? And he said, well, a little vegetable oil. I'm a real alcoholic because a little to me was a half a cup. You know, you drink a half a cup of vegetable oil before you go out drinking. I'm here to tell you that all it does is make it come up a lot easier. You know, I practiced drinking, though, until I got pretty good at it, you know. I divorced that husband. We could not get along. And the last night we spent together, we tried to kill each other. And I'm not proud of that, but that is my story, you know. The last night we were together, he broke 5 of my ribs, and I gave him third-degree burns under his arm from boiling water and pushed him out a second-story window. When the cops came, I was standing on the roof with a vacuum cleaner I was going to drop on his head. Because my thinking was if I killed the son of a gun, that I would be able to collect Social Security. You know, so, and that's before I think I'm an alcoholic, you know. So that's the kind of thinking that's going on in my brain. So we divorced, and after that, I really could drink like I wanted to. You know, I could go where I wanted to go and do what I wanted to do. And then things started to happen for me, you know. I would get good ideas. I would get really good ideas. And I would have to act on them. I realize today that the reason that I acted out my ideas right away was because if I didn't, I'd forget them. And I went to college. I graduated from college. I bought a house I had no business buying, but I bought it anyway. And now I'm beginning to go out and drink and not come home. You know, my kids needed a mother, and I couldn't be the mother that they needed because I was out drinking. Now, here is the thing. I'm an alcoholic mother. I know that I'm an alcoholic mother. I am disgusted with myself. But how does that portray itself to you if I'm sitting in the bar with you, just like it says right here? I'm flirting and raising Cain in the pub and thinking that I am somebody and telling you all the lies in the world that my life is great, my kids are great, everything's wonderful. The real truth of the matter is I'm an alcoholic mother that's pathetic and hopeless. But I'm telling you some wonderful story, okay? So I had a really good job after this college education. I went to work for the federal government. I had a really good job. I was a fiscal manager of a couple of million-dollar company, and I was of a agency, rather, and I was doing a really good job at it. But you see, by now I'm drinking so much that I can't afford to pay for the drinks that I'm drinking. So I have to do what every good alcoholic does. And what we do is we quit a good job to become a bartender. You know, and I always wanted to be a cowgirl, so I got a job in a saloon. And, you know, you had to wear a cowgirl skirt and boots and hat and vest and plaid shirt, and oh boy. And I had it going on, I'm telling you. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And at this time, I was also on my diet plan, which was 2 Dexatrim and 12 light beers a day. And that was 1,200 calories, and I had figured that out. You know, I think I weighed about 97 pounds when I got here, and I didn't eat at all. But anyway, I got this job, and I thought I was so hip, slick, and cool, and I was doing all this stuff, and I'm driving drunk, and I get pulled over by the cops. And at this time in my life, I'm driving a 1972 Pontiac Ventura with no front seat. I don't know what happened to the front seat. I know that I had a milk crate bolted to where the front seat was supposed to be, and I was very good. I'm a Yankee, you know. We think of ingenuity, you know. And like, I'll just get this milk crate. And for the back, I had a piece of plywood, and it was propped up from a 2x4 that was jammed up against the back seat, and I had a pillow on it. And I'm driving home. And the cops... The blue lights come on, you know. They do that irritating thing. Cops have an irritating way of on the window. What are you doing? I don't know. What am I doing? I don't know. But I knew, and I just intuitively knew things. Long before I got here, I intuitively knew things. I knew that if I opened the door of the car and he saw me sitting on a milk crate, that I would probably get arrested. It never occurred to me that I might get arrested for being drunk. I just thought, it's got to be against the law to be driving around sitting on a milk crate. And so he asked me, he said, well, where have you been? And I said, well, do you want me to tell the truth? And he said, absolutely. I said, well, my horse died. And I've just come from burying him. I don't have a horse. And he knew that, too, you know. He was like, oh, well, where do you live? I live just down the road. Why don't you get there? And that was the way my drinking was going to be. Every single time I got pulled over by the cops, I had a reason for why I was doing what I was doing. And it was always a stupid reason, but I thought they made sense. And one time, we were at the saloon. It was really, really hot. And so I thought maybe it would be a good idea if we went skinny dipping after we got out of work. And I was so drunk that I couldn't find my way out of the ladies' room stall. I went in the bathroom, and I couldn't figure out how to unlock the door. So I crawled underneath the door and then come out like, okay, everybody, let's go, you know. So we go, and at this time I had a habit of taking the keys to my car and putting them on the right front passenger tire. I mean, doesn't everybody do that? You know, if you're not going to be driving, you know, put the keys up there. So anyway, we jumped off this bridge. I wouldn't have jumped off this bridge for $1 million. But let me tell you, when I'm drunk, I'll do just about anything. So we jump off this bridge. There's 6 of us, 3 guys, 3 girls, naked, jump off the bridge, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, being very, very quiet. And we see blue lights, and I get a good idea. I say, let's swim downstream. So we swim downstream, and we're in the water, and it's getting cold, but we wait till the cops leave, and then we come up, and we're running through somebody's backyard. You know, and there's six of us, and we're all naked, and we're all drunk, and we're all being quiet. And we get up to the car, and the cops had taken our clothes. One of the guys that was with us was married, and he says, Jesus, Lily, my wife is going to be really pissed if I come home and my hair's all wet. I said, okay then, Gil, I got a good idea. You get in the car, and I'll drive really fast, and you can blow dry your hair. So we all pile in the car, and we're driving down the road, and Gil's got his head stuck out the window, and he's blow drying his hair, and the blue lights come on. And I say to my friends, let me handle this. So they come up, and they rap on the window. What are you doing? And he shines the light in the car, you know. You know how cops hold the light, you know, way up here? They shine the light in the car. Six naked people. And he says, what are you doing? I said, it is really hot. And we're just driving around trying to get cooled off. You know, that's the kind of stuff that my brain thinks of. You know. The truth of the matter is I'm a hopeless, helpless, pathetic, drunk mother. See? But on the outside, I'm this, ha-ha, let's have fun, who cares? You know. In the meantime, the beautiful house that I started with, the beautiful house that I bought, that, like, I used to get these really bizarre ideas. Like, I know I shouldn't be out and staying out all night and leaving my kids home. So maybe I need to figure out how to drink at home. And I came up with a plan that I could buy a 12-pack of beer and strategically place it around the yard, go out there and mow the lawn. When you get to a beer, stop and have one. And it worked. Because I drank the whole 12 beers, and the lawn looked great, and I mowed the lawn every day. And in the fall, I raked the leaves, and in the winter, I shoveled it off. You know, because I was where I was supposed to be, and I could still drink. About the time that my youngest child was 13 years old, I'm really in trouble with alcohol now. I'm really, very seriously in trouble with alcohol. And I still work in a bar. And I have destroyed this beautiful house. And when I say destroyed this house, I'm here to tell you that there were 13 windows in that house. 13 windows had bullet holes in them. I don't know if I was shooting out, the neighbors were shooting in. I have no idea what was going on in that house. I can tell you this, there was no carpet left on the floor. Every window had a bullet hole in it. Every door had a punch hole in it. There was not a door in the house could be locked. Every door had a hole in it. There was a dartboard hanging in the living room, and I had painted my kitchen pumpkin orange because I didn't have enough of any one color. So I mixed it all together, and that's the color it came out, and I painted my living room pumpkin orange. So picture this house now. You walk in the front door, you can't tell the clean clothes and the dirty clothes. My idea of doing dishes was put them in a trash bag, throw them out, and go buy some new ones. That is not how I was brought up. That is not how this girl was brought up. But that's what I had turned into. That's what I had turned into. On the day before my last drunk, I dyed my hair purple. About the color of my dress, actually. I have no idea why I dyed my hair purple. I just thought it was a good idea. And I went to the bar and I told the bartender I thought I might be an alcoholic. They should keep the drinks coming while I made up my mind. By now I'm driving a 15-foot van because I consider myself to be an athlete. And I need to have this van to carry my athletic equipment in. And what I have is a set of dots. And somebody can interpret over there. Dots. And a bed. And a Coleman cooler full of booze. And a change of clothes and makeup. And I don't know. I have no idea. Why did I do that? So I wouldn't have to drive drunk. Wouldn't you do that to not drive drunk? This alcoholic would do that, to not drive drunk. And then at the same time, I got a job working in a school, in an alternative school. I didn't know if I was in the I'm driving a school van. That's my job. I don't know if I'm in the school van or my van. I have to get out of the van to see which van I'm in. If I'm in the school van, how come it was parked at the bar all night? If I'm in my van, I got to go home and get the real van so that I can drive, you know. But I told the bartender I thought I might be an alcoholic. He should keep the drinks coming while I made up my mind. And later in the evening, I told him that I was going to ask God to give me a sign, and if I was really, really an alcoholic, God would give me a sign. The next day, I had 15 kids on board a van. I'm driving across. Back then, we had to drive like 25 miles to the school after we picked the kids up, and I began to sweat profusely, and I thought, geez, I don't feel good. You know, and then I got this pressure in my chest. I'm like, man, I really don't feel good, you know. And then I started having some pain in my jaw, and I knew, and my back. My back was killing me, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm having a heart attack. And all I could think of was, please, God, do not let me go off the road with these kids in this van. And I made it to work, and I collapsed with a heart attack. And I remember waking up in the ambulance on the way to the hospital thinking it didn't need to be that big a sign. And, you know. They had called my family and said they didn't think I was going to make it. But they didn't know at that time that what was wrong with me was a heart attack induced by alcohol. I remember my brother standing there. And when I came to, I had tubes and monitors and, you know, I'm in intensive care and I got a white pillowcase under my head and I'm thinking, your hair is purple. My brother said to me, what happened? And I said, I don't know, but whatever they're giving me, it's turning my hair purple. And you see, and I know that that's a lie, but I'm an alcoholic. And alcoholics tell lies. She was talking about that today, you know. Alcoholics tell lies. We tell lies until we believe them ourselves. That's a real alcoholic, you know. I was convinced that whatever they gave me turned my hair purple. Now, I know that wasn't the truth, but I believed it, you know. I got out of the hospital, so I had my last drink of alcohol on October 28th, 1989. But I consider my sobriety date to be November the 8th, 1989. And this is why. You know, while I was in the hospital, those doctors came every day and they asked me how much I drank, and I was as honest as I knew how to be at the time. You know, I said, well, I drank 12 beers and shots of tequila, and not one of them doctors said to me, well, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? Well, if they didn't think I had a problem with alcohol, maybe I was wrong. Maybe I really don't have a problem with alcohol. But I did know that my house was in a shambles and that I could not let my family take me home. You see, my family had no idea what I had been about. They had no idea that I was a drunk, pathetic, helpless, hopeless, drunk mother. My family didn't know that because I didn't drink around my family. But I'd go to the family outings, and I would always have an excuse why I had to leave. The car's not acting right. I need to get the front tire checked out. Oh, I need to get gas before the gas station closes. Oh, it's going to storm. Yeah, it's going to rain, and I don't have a windshield wiper on that side. You know, whatever I could think of, I had to get out of there. Those people don't drink like I drink now. They might have a drink, and they might not. I don't know anything about that. I know that I have to have a drink, you know. So I didn't hang around with my family. I wasn't inviting my family to my house. And for a long time, I sort of shut my family out. And I'm very sorry about that today. You know, I missed out on a lot of things because I shut my family out. They didn't shut me out. They still loved me. It was just like Tim was talking about last night. My mother still loved me with every breath she had in her. But I shut them out. Shut my kids out emotionally. They needed me. Where was I? I'm sitting on a bar stool every day telling everybody how great my life is. This is what my house looked like. I came home from the hospital on November 8th. It was really cold. I had the person that drove me home drop me off the end of the driveway. I walked up to the door of my house. There was a note on it from the bank. They were foreclosing on my house. When I opened the door, which was not locked, there was no lights, no heat, no running water, no groceries, no telephone, no kids. All there was a mess, a real mess I had created in this house. I mean, it looked like a dump. It wasn't pretty anymore. It was disgusting. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not staying here. So I moseyed myself right up to the bar. And I walked in and I sat down and I ordered a shot of tequila and a beer chaser. And I doctored my hand all up to do that shot. And I looked up and there was a mirror behind the bar. That mirror had always been behind the bar and I'd always sat in the same seat. But for a split second, and I mean when I tell you a split second, it was that fast, I saw who I really was. I was scared to death. I was like, oh my God, you're hopeless. You're pathetic. You're disgusting. You're a drunk. You're a drunk mother, and this is how you act. And it was that fast. I mean, in and out that fast. I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to go to work after having this heart attack. But I put the drink down on the bar and I walked out of there. So that's why I consider November 8th to be my sobriety day. That's the day that I put the drink down on the table and said, no thanks. It changed my mind. I went to work the next day. There was a lady at my work that had taken the time to write me a letter. She was my immediate supervisor. She said, Lily, I want you to take this letter home and read it. I took the letter home. And I'm sitting there reading this letter, and she said that the kids that I worked with and the staff that I worked with loved me very, very much. And it was breaking their heart to see what was happening to me. And it would be her honor to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to stand here tonight and tell you, I thought, well, isn't that wonderful? You know, she wants to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. What I thought was, why don't you mind your own business and stay out of my life? I'm not hurting anyone. But I went to work again the next day, and she says, did you read the letter? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, I'd like to take you to a meeting tomorrow night. Do you think you can not drink between now and then? And I'm like, you know, of course. There's no problem. I can do that. And she says, well, why don't you come to my house to dinner, and then we'll go to a meeting. Well, that's the kind of drunk I am. You see, I'm going to sit on the bar stool, and you're going to come in, and you're going to tell me some problem that you have, and I'm going to help you solve it, and tomorrow I'll be there to help you move. Except when tomorrow comes, I won't be there because I'll be at the bar. Because that's how I am. I make promises. I have no intention of keeping. So I told this girl I'd come to her house for dinner. Well, that night that I was going to ask God for you know, if I'm really an alcoholic, give me a sign. What I did instead was I got in the back of my van and I got on my knees and I said, God, give me 1/10 of the faith that my mother has. Just a smidge. Because I'd thrown my faith out the window. See, and what happened for me that day is that I knew I wasn't going to her house. I am not going. Are you kidding me? Go to her house and have dinner and then go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? What is that? But you know, that same day I went to the doctor and the doctor said to me, Lily, you had a heart attack because you abuse alcohol. And you know how I know that? And I thought, well, I could tell you a couple of reasons why you know that, but what reason do you have? And he said, because when we were doing your test, we discovered that you have stage 3 cirrhosis of the liver. And if you don't quit drinking, you'll be dead in 5 years. And if you can't quit drinking on your own, you ought to go to AA. That's twice in one day, AA. I'm thinking, holy God, that's pretty drastic, AA. Anyway, got closer and closer to the time to go to this girl's house, and I knew I wasn't going to go. Because you see, I'm big bravado, you know. But when it came to following through, I really was like scared to death. I am not going to AA. I don't know what that's all about. Doesn't sound good to me, though. I think it means you can't drink. Or if you do, you have to hide in a closet because you're anonymous. Because I'm wacky, you know. But you see, this little voice in the back of my head sounded like my mother. She wasn't anywhere near me, but I heard this little voice say, if you're not going to go, the least you could do is call because it would be really rude not to show up. And I went to the phone to call her, and when I did, the phone was dead. It never occurred to me to go to a phone booth. They don't even have phone booths anymore, do they? But back then they did, and it never occurred to me to go to one and call her. I drove 15 miles to her house to tell her I couldn't come. And she said, come right in. And she had a gift for me, and it was all wrapped up, and it had a big bow on it. And I unwrapped this gift, and I never want to forget how I felt at that very moment. Because it was a big blue book. And in white letters, it said Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to sweat, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of this? Woo. alcohol. They got a whole book and everything. And so I opened it up, and inside the front cover, she said, "To Lily, my friend with love, may you someday know how important this day is to me. Fasten your seatbelt, and welcome to the greatest adventure of your life, one day at a time." Ooh, I don't know. Anyway, we had dinner, and I went to the meeting. Now, just like, is it Linda? No, this one right here. That, any, say it. Whatever she said her name was, I can't hear her. Anyway, she was saying, you know, going into the rooms and they're being smoke-filled. See, what I thought was the reason they called it anonymous is because you couldn't see who the hell was sitting next to you anyway. But I got there and it was really, really cold out, and there's this old guy standing outside, little short guy, and he's shaking. And I'm thinking, Jesus, somebody get that guy a drink, you know? And he stuck his hand out to me, and he said, "Welcome. You're amongst your own kind." And I thought, I don't think so, bucko. You know. And then I went inside, and the guy inside was as tall as that guy was short. And he had this big belt buckle that was right about my eye level, and it said, "Bullshit." And he pats me on the back, and he's got this big toothy grin, and he's like, "Lily, you just keep coming back on it. It gets better and better and better." I'm like, how the hell does he know who I am? And why does he want me to come back? And what is going to get better? You know. And then I sit down in the third row in the end seat. I have no idea what they're talking about. None. But this lady said, here at the Portland Group, we have a way to help you start a new way of life by offering you a white chip. Now, I have looked around the room and decided that I am in a room full of losers because they're all admitting to be alcoholic, and now they're going to give me a chip, a poker chip. I'm like, I'm sitting in the third row, and I'm thinking, really? You don't drink, and they give you a poker chip. Whoa. Sign me up, right? But the next words she said were the words that saved this drunk's life. Because what she said was, if you're too afraid to pick up a white chip, see me after the meeting and I'll give you one. In my whole life, whenever I was afraid, so I had a grandmother that used to say to me, don't let them see you cry, Lily. Because if they see you cry, they're going to know they got you. So don't let them see you cry. You know, I'm brought up with four boys. I mean, I just, whenever I was scared, I'd just get up and get in your face, you know. And I did that my whole life. If I was afraid of anything. So now she's thrown down a challenge to me, sitting in the third row with purple hair, sticking straight up. And everybody knows I'm new. How do you people know that, you know? She threw down the challenge, if you're too afraid, see me after the meeting. And I thought, well, I'll be seeing you right now, honey. She said, I am coming down there and I'm getting that chip. And I marched down there and I got that chip, and an amazing thing happened. People started applauding, and it sounded like they really meant it, you know, like, whoa, yay, you know. And I'm thinking, what a bunch of screwballs, you know. But anyway, then they said things, I have a disease of perception. So they started saying things like, keep coming back, and I heard, we need you. We need you. And I knew that you did, because this Alcoholics Anonymous outfit is not organized, you know. It's like there are no leaders. There's, you know, trusted servants. I mean, I know all this the first meeting from reading the steps and the traditions. I've already figured it out, which ones I'm doing, which one I'm not. And I'm looking, and I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I need to come back because they need an exalted ruler, and I think I'll keep coming until I'm the exalted ruler of AA. Yeah. Then they say things like, did you get a sponsor? No, I didn't. What is a sponsor, you know? And then they tell you what a sponsor is. You know, it's in the big book. Read what a sponsor is. You're going to get a sponsor? No, I'm not getting a sponsor. I can do this myself. I read those steps. Reading them and doing them is two different things, you know? So they kept bugging me about the sponsor crap. So I finally got a sponsor. And I'm going to these meetings now. Well, before I knew there was a meeting every day, I would go to the mall. At the time, you couldn't buy any alcohol in the mall, so I would go to the mall to keep from drinking. Now, I'm going to tell you, those people at the mall were very happy when I found out there was a meeting every day. Because I would go in there and say, I think you should put this on sale. Why are you climbing up the ladder? Aren't you the manager? You know, like, mind your own business, Lily. But, you know, I didn't know anything about that, you know. So, anyway, I get a sponsor, and this is what she says to me. You call me every morning at 6 o'clock, not 5 minutes off, not 5 minutes past. You call me at 6. And if I was any different time than 6 o'clock, she would not talk to me. And I thought she was rude. I was like, what's up with that anyway? And she says, I'm just trying to teach you how to be responsible. You know, and then she would ask me to read a page in the big book. What page are we going to read? She says, I don't care. Stick your finger in the book. Whatever page it comes up on, that's what we're reading. So we read the big book. What does that mean to you? I have no idea. But we worked the steps out of that big book. And we started with step one. See, and my smart thinking when I got her for a sponsor was I used to drink with this girl so I wouldn't have to do 4 and 5. Well, if you have a good sponsor, you're going to do all the steps. So she'd say to me, at 6 o'clock in the morning, she'd say things like, okay, so we've read the reading for the day. We've discussed it. Where are you going to a meeting tonight? Now, I'm smart. I got that book out. I know before I talk to her what meeting I'm going to. Well, I think I'll go to the Tuesday night meeting. She'd say, great, pick me up. Then I knew that she called this other lady because, you see, for the first 60 days, every time I went to a meeting, there would be this little lady that would get up and speak. Every time. Hi, everyone. My name's Jane. And I'm happy, joyous, and free. And I'm like... And then I figured out that the reason I had to tell her what meeting I was going to was so she could call up Happy, Joyous, and Free and get her to go to the meeting so she could tell me that she was happy, joyous, and free. That's the thinking of an alcoholic, you see. Yeah, I'm nuts. That's what I am. I'm absolutely nuts. But I start working these steps, and right away I'm like, these people in Alcoholics Anonymous are really stupid, you know. Because every single meeting you go to, they have to read how it works. Are you stupid? Cunning, baffling, powerful, fatal, progressive, it's going to get you. And I'm thinking, lighten up. Lighten up, you guys. So about 30 days sober, I came up with this idea that I thought what I would do is I would just go get the 30-day chip. I called it the blood chip. That is not what they call it, but that's what I called it. And I'm going to go get this blood chip, and then I'm going to Charlie's and get drunk. Because you people are way too serious. Cunning, baffling, powerful. You read the same thing every time you go to the meeting. They read the same thing. You know, like, well, you think I'm dumb? I got it. So I go to the meeting, and this lady gets up at the podium, and she's got a Christmas tree on her head. And it's all lit up. Sparkly lights on it, playing, you know, Rock Around the Christmas Tree or some foolishness. She got on a Hawaiian shirt, 2 different colored socks, and I'm sitting in the front row because they said, Lily, you need to sit in the front row. We want you to sit right in front of the speaker. Why do I have to sit in the front row? Because you're nosy. What do you mean I'm nosy? You're going to want to know, are they together? How'd she get her hair like that? I wonder where she got those shoes. Oh, I like that jacket. Sit in the front row and pay attention to the speaker. So this woman gets up and she goes, hi, everyone. My name's Ricky, and I'm an alcoholic, and if I don't drink between now and May 1st, I'll be sober for 15 years. And I'm sitting in the front row directly in front of her in a meeting of about 150 people, and I holler, yes, you're crazy. I'm so excited. Thank God there's another wingnut in this program, you know. Oh. After the meeting, I get up. I think I wrinkled her shirt permanently. I was like, oh, do you think you could help me? Oh, you seem to be having a good time. Oh, I can't stand it. It's cunning and baffling and powerful and progressive and fatal. And oh, my God. And she'd say, honey, it's rule 62. Just relax. Then her significant other, guess who her significant other is? The bullshit buckle guy. Yeah. So I'm like 6 months sober now, and I mean, I am following the rules. I am doing what they have told me to do. I had a sponsor that told me that I needed to clean my house using the 3-foot method. I was like, the 3-foot method? What's that? She said, well, you open the front door, and you clean the first 3 feet, and you figure out what you're going to do with all that crap. If you're throwing it away, take it away. If you're keeping it, put it away. Wash the walls, wash the ceiling, wash the floor. When you get all done, get a chair. Put it in the 3-foot area and call me. You know what I'm thinking of the sponsor, right? Like, how do you guys come up with this crap anyway? But I did it. And I called her and I said, what now? And she said, the next 3 feet. You know, I completely restored that house on the 3 foot method. Had all new windows, carpet on the floor. You know, amazing. I owed the bank money. I said to her, I don't know what I'm going to do about that. She said, why don't you call the bank manager and make an appointment? Tell him you're an alcoholic. Well, there's a bright idea. But, you know, you got to do what they tell you. So I call the bank manager. I make an appointment. I go sit down with him. I go, hi. I said, I'm an alcoholic. He goes, we know. Huh. We've seen some of the checks you write. You know.
Yeah.
So I make a plan with him to pay the money back. I go home, I call my sponsor as I was told to do, and she's, what happened? I said, well, I made a plan with them. I said, they don't want the house. I said, I don't really want it either. I said, it should be bulldozed over. And she said, well, clean it on the 3 foot method. And what did he say? I said, he said that he would make a payment plan with me. I said, what do I do now? She says, pay him. Pay him? And she says, and if you have to go without cigarettes and soda, whatever it is you like, that's what you do. She says, but you pay him. And I did. I paid him. Until I paid that house off. You know? Anyway, I want to tell you a little story about Mr. Bullshit. He threatened Ricky and I one day, and I was sober, and he says, you know, if you girls were any kind of girls, you'd go in the hospital and visit Ernie. Ernie's in the hospital from up country, and he hasn't had any visitors, and you girls ought to go in there and visit him. This is long before they had the HIPAA laws and all that, right? So Ricky says to me, you be at the Maine Medical Center tomorrow, and you wear a hat. Okay. So I show up the next day at the appointed time with a fish hat on my head. Looked like Jaws. It's the only hat I had. She gets out of the car, and she's got a fish hat on, and she's got a fish pocketbook and fish shoes and fish shirt. I'm like, how did she know I was going to wear a fish hat, you know? Now, she was a trained operatic singer, and I can't sing. But my mom always said, if you can't sing good, sing loud. So I say to this woman, Ricky, I can't really sing, but Mama says if you can't sing good, sing loud, and I know all the words to give my regards to Broadway. She said, great, that's what we'll sing. So we go into the hospital, and we go up to the information desk. Where's Ernie? Ernie from up country. We don't know Ernie's last name. No, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't ever tell anybody your last name. Ernie from up country. Yeah, he's up on the third floor. We go up to the third floor, up to the nurse's station. Where's Ernie? Ernie's right over there. So we go in, and she goes, hi, Ernie. She says, we're friends of Bill W. Hit it. Give my regards to Broadway. We do this whole little routine, right? We get all done, and Ernie goes, who the hell is Bill W? But you got to be willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. You know, you get sober and you think everything's going to be sunshine and roses, and that's just not the case. You know, life stuff happens to people. So I had three children. I had four children in 7 years, and one died as a result of SIDS. And I never grieved that loss. I didn't know anything about how to do that at the time. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and two out of three of my kids are raging alcoholics. No wonder. The example that I set for them, right? I don't blame myself for their alcoholism today, but back then I was sure it was because of me, that I had caused them to be alcoholics. Anyway, my sponsor told me to mind my own business, and she said the only thing you can be to those kids is a power of example. And she also said, Lily, you need to get involved in service work. Service work is important. She said, and it will be what saves your life. She said, you don't really, your kids are grown now. She said, so why don't you go volunteer at the Central Service Office? And I went down to the Central Service Office and became a volunteer, answering the telephone. And one day my daughter called asking for help. I don't recommend that you 12-step your own kids, but for me that's just the way it happened. I turned around to the director of the program and I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, yes, you do. You get another woman. And you go sit on the edge of the bed and you tell her that it doesn't have to be like this. And that there's a way out, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And my daughter is sober today. She's sober for 23 years. I have a son that, as of this morning, is 3 days sober. The hardest thing that I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous is watch this kid killing himself with booze and drugs. Absolutely bar none, the hardest thing I've ever done. In March of 2002, March 27th of 2002, I was asked to go and speak at a convention in New Jersey. And I have this other son that was always the superhero in the family, did everything he ever wanted to do. He wanted to be a Marine, he was a Marine. He wanted to play hockey, played hockey. He wanted to be Little League, he wanted to be the All-Stars, he was in the All-Stars. This kid did the things that he set goals and he did them, you know. And he was a delight, everybody's life, everybody loved Sam. Everybody loves Sam. So I called Sam and I said, Sam, I said, I'm going to be speaking at a convention in New Jersey. And he's like, really? And I said, yeah. And he goes, Mom, he says, that's great. He says, I'll drive up to Delaware and take the ferry across and I'll see you there. My son was a police officer in Washington, D.C. at that time. He had been in the Marine Corps. He had been the Marine of the cycle. He had a job at one point working for the Department of Defense for the government, and his job was to protect foreign dignitaries. And he was part of the detail that protected John Paul XXII. And he said the greatest thrill of his life was being embraced by Mother Teresa. So anyway, I'm going to speak at this convention, and he takes the ferry, and he comes across, and he bops in with his red Jeep. And Jerry and Jill were at this convention, and they got to meet him, and we had a wonderful weekend. Oh, my God, it was fabulous, you know. And we're running down to the water and putting our feet in the ocean, and people are like, what's wrong with you people? You know, I said, well, it's like the ocean in Maine in the summertime, so it's no big deal to us, you know. And then I said to him, I want you to help me pick up these white rocks. And he said, why? And I said, because your crazy mother leads women's retreats now, and I need these white rocks. I don't know what I'm going to use them for, but I need them. He said, okay. So we pick up white rocks. We race to the top of the Cape May Lighthouse. We had the most wonderful weekend. I made my amends to that kid that weekend, you know. Made my amends, cleaned up my side of the street. That's what it's about, cleaning up my side of the street. And six weeks later, I got the phone call that no mother wants to get. Sammy was gone. Sammy passed away. I talked to Sammy on Monday, and he said, I think I'm getting the flu. And I was like, oh, don't be such a wush. You know, take a couple of aspirin, drink lots of juice, you'll be fine. And the next night at 10 minutes or 2 in the morning, I got the phone call that no mother wants to get. Sammy passed away, and he had died of a septic shock. And the first thing I did was get on my knees and pray. You know, 1/10 of my faith had been restored. And I get on my knees and I pray to the Blessed Mother. And I said, please come and help me, because you know what it's like to bury a son. You watch them murder yours. And I have to tell you that I felt the arms of a spirit envelop me and help me. More importantly, I want you to know that I could only make one phone call after that. I called my best friend who was in AA. And I could barely get the words out of my throat, you know, my son was dead. And you know, within a matter of an hour, everybody in AA was there for me. You know, I had been involved in service at every level. You know, I had been involved in service from answering the phone at the hotline all the way up through the state level. And people surrounded me with love. My son had a hero's funeral. They loved him in Washington, D.C. They all came, like 70 police officers came from Washington, D.C. to his funeral. They brought his cruiser. It was like draped in black, and then the other guys came with their cruisers, and they gave me and my grandchildren rides up and down the street with talking to people on the street through these, you know. But we get to the funeral home, and there's an honor guard there for my son, you know. They stay with his body 24 hours a day until he's buried. My son's police partner comes up to me, and he gives me a hug, and he says, Lily, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And I said, like what? And he goes, I've been to a lot of funerals for a lot of cops, but I have never seen anybody with as many friends as you have. And I said, well, they couldn't all come. And he said, what? And I said, well, they wanted to, but when they got here and saw all these cruisers, they kept on going. You know, I'm drinking with the boys at the dump on the hump, you know. They're, like, not keen on going someplace where there's a lot of cops. But I said, as I stand before you today telling you that I buried that child and it broke my heart, that God had a use for me and I didn't know what that was. You know, I remember my friend saying to me, oh, Lily is such a power example. And inside my chest, I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to be an effing power example if it has to hurt this much. This sucks. I don't want to do it. But here's the miracle. I'm a pathetic, hopeless, drunk woman mother, and I never thought about a drink, not once. And the people in AA surrounded me with love, and they showed me how to stand up and to be tall and to walk so that my son would be proud of me. You know, they had a blue mass for my son in Washington, D.C. I went to that. I'm thinking, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to get through this? But we go and they have a parade, and I'm in this cruiser, and there's a parade. We go down the street, and I don't know how many police officers there were, but they were all there, all dressed in their dress blues, all saluting me as I'm riding in this police car to the church. And they decided that they would have it in this little church where he worked. He worked in part of Washington, D.C., called Anacostia. And I'm thinking to myself, I just don't know how I'm going to get through this, you know. I just don't know. And the chaplain of the police department opens the cruiser and says, how are you doing? And I said, I'm okay, I think. And I'm like, going to go inside this church. And they had called me and asked me if I would give my son's eulogy. And I'm brought up in AA. When anybody in AA asks you anything, you always say yes. So I'm like, yeah, okay. That's what you want me to do? Okay, fine. And now I'm there and I'm thinking, I can't do my son's eulogy. What is not wrong with me? But anyway, I'm like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this, Sammy. You have got to help me. And we walk in to this little white church in Anacostia. And the carpet is the same color as my dress and my hair was when I got here. And they have the worst looking picture of my son I ever saw sitting on a white piano. And I'm thinking, okay, thanks. You know. But I was able to speak on and eulogize my son. But do you think that's the hardest thing I've ever been through in AA? No. The hardest thing I've ever been through in AA is watching this other kid suffer from the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. Nothing can compare to that. Because, you see, he's been sober before. He was sober one time for 10 years. And he went back out. And he's not been able to find his way back. It's cost him visitation with his child. The price that he's paying is beyond anything that I think I could pay to still be out there. But I don't know, because I'm a real live alcoholic. And the choices that I made when my kids needed me was to sit in the bar and be Kalian. You know, that's what I thought of. But I've watched this kid suffer. And I've watched this kid on the streets. And I watched this kid. I was called and told that he was in intensive care and that I needed to come immediately. And I went and I saw him. And what I saw scared me to death. I thought, oh my God, he's going to die. And the doctor said to me, no, he's probably going to live. And I said, well, maybe this will be the thing that gets him back to AA. And he said, unfortunately, he's not going to remember any of this. You're the one that will remember. You know? And it breaks my heart to see him suffering when I know that there's a program of recovery just waiting. You know. But today he sent me a message. He says, Mom, I just wanted to let you know that I'm thinking of you and I'm 3 days sober. You know, I ask all of you, his name is Tom, and I ask every one of you to pray for him. You know, help me to pray for him. Maybe this kid will get sober again. You know. Because I'll tell you, if he doesn't, he's going to die. Because he's done all the things that Tim was talking about. He's been in jail. He's been in the hospital. He's been in the nut house. He's been all of those places. The only place left for him now is the morgue. And if I have to bury him, I know that I can do that. Because the people in AA will hold me up again. I don't want to do it. I don't want to see anybody suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And so when I am asked to come to a place like Columbus, Georgia, I say gladly, I would be delighted to be there. I will be delighted to be here with you. Because all of you, no matter what, all of you are in the same boat I'm in. We're recovering from a disease that will kill us. And we think it doesn't hurt anybody, but it hurts everybody. So I'd like to close by reading an adaptation of the Footprints Prayer that I was stranded in an airport in Detroit from being on a speaking engagement one night, and there was a blizzard going on in the Northeast. And when I went to the airport to ask if I could make my flight the next day, the girl said, "No, you can't, because the planes are still flying." And I said, "I don't think so. CNN is on the TV there, and they're going virtual whiteout from D.C. north." And I said, "I live in Maine. You know, that's like the last state before Canada. And I don't want to get stuck in Detroit." But I got stuck in Detroit. So I go to Detroit. I have on red cowboy boots because the girls in Texas thought I should have purple ones. We couldn't find purple, so we got red. And I'm traipsing through the airport, and I see this little old lady going the other way. The third time that I saw her, I thought, well, I'm supposed to do something about that little old lady. Okay, God. So I go over and I say, "Are you traveling alone?" And she says, "Yes, I am." And I said, "Well, why don't you stay with me and we'll be safe together, the two of us. And I'll watch over you and your things during the night." So I go and I find a chair, the most comfortable one I can find. And I get her in it and I say, "How's that? Is everything okay now?" She says, "No." I said, "What's the matter?" She says, "I need a blanket and a pillow." And I said, "Okay." So I go traipsing through the airport looking for a blanket and a pillow. You know, I finally find a blanket and a pillow, bring it back, get her all tucked in. I said, "How's that?" She says, "Good." I said, "You all set now?" She goes, "No." I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "You'd think, for God's sakes, if they were going to strand us in this airport all night, they'd leave the bar open so we could get good and drunk." And I'm thinking, great. I picked up the alcoholic old lady, you know. That's the way I do. So while I was watching over her, I got this idea to, I was reading the Footstep Prayer, and this is what I came up with. One night a man had a dream that he was looking down at the beach and he saw a set of footprints drunkenly zigzagging in circles. Then he saw two sets of footprints, one large, one small, one his, one God's. Next, the small footprints stepped into the large footprints and began to grow. Then once again, the footprints were zigzagging round and about with wild abandon. This really bothered the man, and he said to God, "When I asked for help, you came and walked with me." And God said, "Yes, I gave you the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you began to put them into practice, you began to grow." The man replied, "Then God, I don't understand. If I was doing the footwork, what happened? Why the wild zigzagging again?" And God said, "Oh, my precious one, I would not abandon you. After you learned the steps, we danced." I hope you stick around for the dance. Thank you for having me.